for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. China's president is in the U.S. on his first state visit, but little progress on issues like cyber espionage and unfair business practices is expected. The government of German Chancellor Merkel comes under pressure over Volkswagen's misconduct, and Saudi Arabia orders a safety review after more than 700 pilgrims are killed in a stampede near Mecca. Here for the week's top international stories on the Friday News Roundup, Moises Naim of El País and the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, Nancy Youssef of the Daily Beast, and Jeff Dyer of the Financial Times. As always, you are a welcome participant in the Friday News Roundup. Give us a call, 800-433-8850. Send us an email to drshow@wamu.org. Follow us on Facebook or send us a tweet. And welcome to all of you.
Good morning,
Hello.
Diane.
Good morning.
Good to see you all. Jeff Dyer, China's president, Xi Jinping, is certainly under a bit of a cloud as he makes his first official visit here to the States. Talk about what he's here to do and say.
Well, this is a first state visit. This is the Chinese leader has been in power for 3 years now. The Obama administration has tried to build up a very strong rapport with this leader, so this is the fifth series of summits that they've had. And what the Obama administration hoped to do was to really put a lot of pressure on him, particularly over cybersecurity, cyber theft, cyber hacking, and also over complaints they have about the South China Sea. It doesn't seem as if there's going to be a lot of progress on this front, but what you are beginning to see coming out of the summit is what we saw in the last summit they had last year, was that climate change is beginning to become a very important part of diplomacy between the two countries. They announced a big climate change agreement last year where they set targets for their emissions. This year we've seen as an important step by the Chinese. They're talking about launching a carbon trading program and setting a price for carbon over the next couple of years, which is an important part of them bringing their emissions under control. And so what you see is climate change diplomacy becoming this kind of buffer at a time when there are so many tensions over cyber issues, over military issues. Climate change is becoming one of the things, the positive things they can talk about and get on.
But what about cyber espionage, Nancy? To what extent can there at least be some conversation?
Well, I think President Xi tried to start that conversation. He started his trip in Seattle and called cyber espionage, cyber hacking illegal. The White House responded, frankly, that it was dubious about that. And so there seems to be the early signs of a beginning of a dialogue, but it's built on mutual mistrust, as China is suspected of taking part of some of the biggest attacks on American businesses and government agencies. And so where that can go, there's no expectation out of this trip that we'll see a major breakthrough on that, but with the threat of sanctions, with the threat of this becoming a breaking issue between the two countries, it is sort of the opening step, if you will, sort of having that conversation.
Moises, with the Chinese government in the economic situation it's in, does that give the White House a little more leverage?
Of course, and one of the purposes of the visit of President Xi Jinping is to try to calm down markets, is try to build confidence in an economy that is slowing down. They had a huge devaluation. There is of the currency, capital is flying away, investment is retrenching or being more suspicious and timid in China. So there is the need to stabilize this economy. And remember, big legitimacy, a big part of the legitimacy of the Communist Party and of President Xi Jinping to govern the Chinese is to deliver a double-digit growth that creates employment and higher salaries. And if that compact with Chinese society starts to be weaker, then that may bode more instability in China.
Is that beginning to show its cracks? BRICS?
Well, you've certainly seen a very rocky few months in the Chinese economy. The official figures are that it's growing about 7%, but most people think that's probably not true, that it's maybe 6%, 5%, maybe even a lot slower than that. You've seen the stock market crash, as Moises was saying. You've had this problem with the currency devaluation. And what is in the background on this trip is that for the last 30 years, the Chinese leadership have had this incredible reputation for economic competence. What everyone thinks of their politics, their diplomacy, whatever else, they were seen as people who really had a very strong handle on how to run the economy, these very competent technocrats. That's the issue that's been called into question in the last few months, and that's the sort of the cloud that's hanging over Xi Jinping in this visit and what he's trying to convince people so that, yes, we've still got it under control.
You know, I want to say, broadly speaking, we're going to see all the pomp and circumstance of a state visit, the 21-gun salute, a state dinner. But I saw a wonderful description about the sort of the greater undertone of all this is two nations who have a shallow understanding of each other's intentions. And I thought that was a wonderful way to sum up the sort of the underlying problem that hits all these issues, climate change, China's actions in the South China Sea, cyber, Iran, all these issues. And so what you're seeing from the U.S. perspective is this push-pull of sometimes containment, sometimes engagement. And I think we're going to see a little bit of both play out this week.
And therein lies the challenge. These, as Nancy says, are two countries, huge countries, that don't understand each other. And yet this is the most important bilateral relationship in the world, in the way in which the United States and China agree or disagree will have consequences that are global in nature. And, you know, let's not forget that just 2 weeks ago, Susan Rice, the National Security Council's, the head of the National Security Council, was in China, threatening the leadership with sanctions because the Obama administration has essentially is exasperated and fed up with the constant attacks and the hacking attacks and the cyber attacks against the United States that originate in China. So she was very, reportedly, it was a very tough conversation, and as a result of that, the Chinese government sent a very large mission of experts and security of officers to the United States, and they had detailed negotiations about a framework that they will try to agree and launch during this visit.
All right, let's turn to Germany, which is facing its own problems, Nancy, with the resignation of the Volkswagen CEO, Mr. Winterkorn, who resigned over this emission scandal. Get us up to speed.
Well, it's one of the, I have to tell you, one of the more interesting corporate scandals I've seen in a few years. So Germany's Volkswagen, which is a huge employer in Germany and, frankly, emblematic of their efficiency and their ability to manufacture, was putting out what they said were clean diesel cars. And as it turns out, there was a computer system that they had created such that when the car was being tested, it came back with low levels of nitrogen oxide, which is a pollutant. And when it went out onto the streets, the system basically turned off. Now, why is this important? Because cars run a lot better without having to deal with that silly pollution problem, as it were. And so this was a big deal for them because they were selling. They'd come up with this way to have clean cars. And as it turns out, they did not. And this has huge implications. It's called a defeat device. It was the EPA that spotted it with the help of some private researchers at West Virginia University. And it all came out last week. And he said, the CEO, Volkswagen, and said, we're going to investigate, and nobody really believed he would be able to survive this, and he was not. He claims he didn't know, but the depth and the scale of this to affect 500,000 cars in the United States alone suggests that there is some deeper problem. And so this has been a hit to Germany's image, and could face major fines. The defeat device fine in the U.S., the standard one is $37,500 per car, or $18 billion for the number of cars affected.
What were they thinking? That is what everyone is asking. You know, how can a company like that assume that they can do this in such a large scale, global scale, and get away with it?
But here's the thing that we heard on this program on Wednesday. If one company is doing this and succeeding, its competitors are likely doing the same thing. So one wonders if this is going to stop with Volkswagen, or is it perhaps the same in other companies.
Well, this is one of these situations where I'm not a car expert, and I possibly suspect that the rest of us are not as well. But it's one of these situations when this news came out, the car experts I know said, well, we all know that the companies lie about this stuff. And of course, we had no idea. But like, it's the same pattern you've seen in a lot of other corporate scandals, including the financial crisis, where you have companies across an industry chipping away at the regulations, cheating a little bit here, cheating a little bit there, and then the company goes a little bit further and a little bit further, and then you get a situation like Volkswagen where all of a sudden they're just way out of line, and they finally get caught.
If one of them is cheating and getting away with it and saving money as a result and selling cars as a result, somebody else can do it.
So there are two silver linings to this scandal. One is, as you say, that they're going to be, now every car company is going to be scrutinized, and perhaps we'll discover that this is a common practice. And so let's see. Let's wait and see if this is...
Absolutely.
But then there's another silver lining, Diane, and that is some commentators that do know about the car industry have said that this is going to be a big boost to the development of electric cars. And that, of course, is good news. If, as a result of all this, the mechanics and the engineering associated with combustion cars changes, that opens the door for a more rapid development and market presence of electric cars in a larger scale.
Moises Naim, the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, and chief international columnist for El País. Short break, we'll be right back.
DCS Daily.
DCS Daily.
DCS Daily.
It's news,
culture, and curiosities.
From the District, Tacoma Park,
Alexandria,
Friendship Heights,
Hyattsville,
Falls Church,
Northeast Washington, D.C., in your inbox every weekday afternoon.
DCS Daily.
Sign up at dcs.com/newsletter.
dcs.com/newsletter.
And welcome back to the international segment of our Friday News Roundup. This week with Jeff Dyer. He's foreign policy correspondent for the Financial Times, author of The Contest of the Century, The New Era of Competition with China, and How America Can Win. Nancy Youssef is senior defense national security correspondent for The Daily Beast. Moises Naim is the author of The End of Power, From Boardrooms to Battlefields and Churches to States, Why Being in Charge Isn't What It Used to Be. And the Pope is telling us to think differently about what capitalism is. He spoke today at the United Nations. He spoke to a joint meeting of the Congress yesterday. How much of an impact, either here in the States or around the world, do you believe the Pope's message will have an impact, Moises?
This Pope has been a refreshing change, and is having a huge impact, not just by what he says, but what he does and the way he behaves and the kinds of initiatives he takes. And his message was, I think it's going to be heard, and his message was, for example, when he was in Cuba, he gave a big speech where he stressed that ideologies, one need to be wary of ideologies and rigid ways of thinking about politics and the market, and that those kinds of rigid approaches backfire and not desirable. He was talking to a group of very young people. And his point is that it's not just about the market or the government and the state. His point is about how to better intertwine and combine both, because you need both. You cannot just do it by markets working alone, and you cannot just do it by governments alone. So his message is our challenge challenges, how to intertwine markets and governments in a way that serve the poor, that pay attention to inequality, and that create more opportunities for everyone.
And speaking of those who are experiencing extraordinary hardship, the migrants who are moving out of war-torn areas, trying to get into various parts of Europe. The European Union voted on Tuesday to distribute 120,000 asylum seekers among member states. How are they all reacting to this, Jeff?
If you like, if you think last week, you know, we were focusing very much on the humanitarian aspect of this crisis. I think this week we started to see very clearly the way that this is tearing apart almost the fabric of the European political project. I mean, I don't want to overstate it, but you're seeing all sorts of indications of that. So the plan you talked about this week was very unusual for European politics because it was forced through. Usually the EU likes to do things by consensus. Everyone agrees to something. This one was forced through over the objections of four Eastern European countries who are now all accusing the Germans of being the big bully again, of having really forced them. You have the Brits are essentially turning their back on the whole thing and not getting involved in the discussion, and it's accelerating the process where maybe Britain might think about leaving the EU. You have a situation where the Serbs are calling the Croats Nazis because of what they're doing. You also have the EU this week raising the issue about putting border controls back into various countries, which is symbolically and in practical terms a hugely important part of the European project, was the way that border controls came down. So all across the board you're seeing these very kind of deep-seated historical and political tensions coming back to the force. Coming back to the surface, push because of the intense pressure from this refugee crisis.
What could this mean, combined with the VW situation, for Angela Merkel?
Not just the VW situation, but the Greece bailout of just a few months ago as well, where essentially she was in the role again of being perceived as the bully. I mean, I think you're seeing two different things. One is you're seeing Germany very much stepping up as being the leader in all these issues. I mean, she's been, and on the refugee issue, she's been an incredibly positive force. Germany's taking a huge amount, 800,000 in the next decade.
Yeah.
I mean, she's the one who's trying to force Europe to come to terms with the humanitarian aspects of it. But at the same time, she is building up all this resentment about a very powerful Germany that has deep historical roots across Europe and is causing lots of political friction.
Can I just add, though, Germany, there is a demographic issue at hand that I think has contributed to their ability or willingness to take in refugees, in the sense that they have a shortage of workers who can work in factories, and that this does serve a need for them. I hate to say it, but it almost has become cliche when we talk about the European Union and this battle between unity and national sovereignty. We went through this, as you mentioned, with the Greek crisis, and now with this issue of migrants and distributing money and people. When I heard the story, my first question was, what happens if more than 120,000 refugees come into the European Union in the time that this agreement has been spelled out between now and when the next agreement is? Who's going to enforce making adjustments? How do you enforce such a thing like this, given the economic pressures, given the, as you mentioned, the hope for consensus, and a refugee issue that is really overwhelming the framework with which the European Union operates under?
So we thought that the financial crisis would test the European project. Then we thought that the Greek crash would test it. And now we're seeing a real test in which they have to contend with massive numbers of people coming to Europe. And as Nancy says, the more you create conditions for that in Europe to accept them, and the more dire the situation is in their home countries, you all risk having even more people coming and without a clear solution. So is this going to be solved with more Europe or with less Europe or with no Europe? And by that I mean, is this going to create more conditions for Europe to act together in a coordinated, cohesive way, or is this going to break Europe down, or is this just going to create stagnation in their decision making?
Talk about what's happening between Serbia and Croatia.
That's an example of less Europe,
exactly.
Right? They are, instead of getting together and try to decide that this is a joint problem that they have and work together for solutions and seek help from Germany and others, they are essentially building fences and they are denouncing each other for, you know, with historic insults and all that. The other story here is, you know, the EU meets and decides on quotas that they assign to different countries. So each country now has a number that of immigrants that they have to accept. Why if they don't? What happens if Hungary, for example, says, you know, you gave me the quota, but, you know, I'm not accepting any. And so that's, again, is going to test quite severely what the meaning of Europe and the ability of Europe to work together.
And what about the U.S. role? And to what extent is, I think it was John Kerry who said, we are going to, by the end of 2017, take in 100,000 of these refugees, migrants, the differentiation there. How significant is that number, Jeff?
So, the U.S. has increased the number of refugees going to take in for the next couple of years by 30,000 people. That's a large number of people, and the U.S. has historically been the biggest receptor of refugees, has played an outsized role in this process. I think one of the risks you're starting to see with the U.S. reaction is it's starting to break down a little bit along partisan political lines, where you're seeing pressure on the left for a much stronger humanitarian response from the U.S. to this unique Syrian crisis in particular. But you're starting to see some rhetoric on the right, which might start to play into the election campaign, linking it with the immigration issue, but also people suggesting that maybe some of these people could be terrorists and linking the refugees with the terrorism issue. There is a real risk that it will start to kind of tear apart and become a partisan bun fight.
That's an interesting point. And yet there's been an unwillingness to really confront the underlying issue, the Syria crisis, in a bipartisan way. You haven't even had the authorization for the U.S. military involvement and the airstrikes there. So the partisanship shows up on the sort of the effect, but not in addressing the cause, the instability and the fracturing of the Syrian state that has led to this migration crisis to begin with.
So now you have an agreement between President Obama and Russian President Putin to meet on Monday at the UN General, at the annual session of the UN General Assembly. What has leaked about that? What is likely to come out of that conversation? Was it truly Putin who asked for it?
They have not met in the last 15 months. Again, this is another important relationship that between the United States and Russia that is now very frail and full of conflicts. So this all starts when Putin decides to increase the military presence of Russia in the Middle East and specifically in Syria. He announced that the Russians were going to launch airstrikes against ISIS. They have increased arms supplies to the Syrian military. They have increased, they had a base in Syria for many years, and so they are expanding their presence. And that forced the hands of President Obama in Syria and of Europe. Now they have multiple objectives. They need to defeat ISIS or at least contain its expansion. They have the huge refugee crisis that needs attention.
And they also have Assad.
And they want to get rid of Assad. And in the middle of all that comes in Putin and with the Russian military, which for the second time Russia. Is a game changer in the dynamics in Syria.
It was a very interesting week in terms of what the Russians were doing and the U.S. response or lack thereof. You had Russians now starting drones surveillance, manned aircraft with pilots doing surveillance, and not only doing surveillance, but doing surveillance in Western Syria over Idlib, which suggests that rather than going after ISIS as the first target, they are going to go after those opponents who are not ISIS, such that potentially they create a state where your choices are Assad or ISIS by the areas in which they're in. And you had the Secretary of Defense come out yesterday and say, essentially, we're going to wait and see what happens and then determine how to respond. And as someone who spends every day in the Pentagon, you feel the frustration of what General Dempsey, the outgoing chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, called a stalemate, and the inability of the United States to really hold on to control to the outcome of the war there. I thought the most interesting piece that came out was one by the New York Times, in which the Obama apparently was not enthusiastic about the Syrian and Train and Equip program, had felt he'd been dragged along in the Syria conflict. And you see a White House almost dissing itself. So the question I'm left with is how much is there's what the military wants, what the administration wants. How much is the administration really that upset about Russia coming in and trying to take on this intractable problem?
Well, the big outstanding question from what Russia's doing in Syria is Putin doing this because he wants to try and save Assad, or is he doing this because he thinks Assad is going to collapse and he wants to sort of increase his leverage over the, you know, the next stage, over what happens after Assad? If it's the latter, then maybe there is a new opening for some kind of negotiation and bring together all the other different outside powers and try and think about a talk about, you know, moving, you know, political transition away from the Assad regime. So what you're seeing is that, you know, Nancy's talking about the Pentagon reaction. The State Department reaction is, yes, we very much need to talk to Putin at this stage. We need to explore what he's up to, and we need to see if there is a possible negotiation that we can kick off here.
And you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. But can the two men really talk with one another?
And the subtitles to that conversation is sanctions, because Putin is also, of course, it's Syria and it's the presence, the military presence and all of that. But what Putin really wants is the sanctions that the international community, and led by the United States and the European Union, have on his country are eliminated. The Russian economy is hurting
badly,
and it is a double whammy of low oil prices and very biting sanctions. And so, you know, it's impossible to imagine that Putin and President Obama meet and that that subject doesn't come in some way in the conversation.
Arguably, in a way, that there's no expectation of any great breakthroughs. This is an hour conversation that's very informal. But in a way, it's ancillary because you have, in the span of a few weeks, Russia becoming a key part of the UN talks next week. Their actions in Ukraine, their actions in Syria. They've gone from being a side player to a major player to world events, and I think Putin wants that as much as he wants all the things that we've discussed here.
Can we talk for a moment about this deadly stampede near Mecca on Thursday that left more than 700 people dead? How much do we know about how and why this happened, Moises?
There is a very interesting article today in the Washington Post dissecting the nature of these stampedes. It also gives a context in terms of this doesn't only happen in Mecca. It happens frequently around the world where there is just a lot of people. Essentially, the article says that this happens when people in the front of large concentrations of people walking stops, and those on the back don't know that and continues to walk until they crush people in the middle. And apparently there is a pattern to this, and it has been seen in accidents like that in Europe and elsewhere. So the problem here is, you know, this in Saudi Arabia comes in the hill of 2 weeks ago, a crane fell also in Mecca and killed 111 people and injured almost 400 people. This one, as you said, the stampede killed 717 people and hurt more than 800.
But is it that there is disorderliness, or is it that As you say, they just don't.
The Saudi government has spent an immense amount of money and trying to organize this. In much of their legitimacy as the custodians of the holy places derives on the fact that they are able to organize and facilitate large concentration
but
of people every year.
You had more than 11,000 people yesterday on the ellipse here, and it was orderly going in, orderly coming out. I realize it may be even more thousands going into Mecca, but what is the mechanism that drives people to keep pushing?
Look, I mean, we don't know the answer, but it's surely something to do with just a panic reaction when you fear something.
Panic.
It's the only thing where I can think can really explain it is a natural human panic when you just feel surrounded by so many people, fears have been pressed around, and people panic.
All right. We have to take a short break on that sad note. When we come back, we'll open the phones. We also want to talk about Greece and the re-election of Alex Tsipras. Stay with us. And welcome back. Time to open the phones. Let's go first to Kathleen. She's in Sterling, Virginia. Kathleen, you're on the air.
Hi, thank you. What I'd like to say is the EU sets quota numbers, and that is each country will take in X amount of immigrants, but it does not provide sufficient funding for these countries. Then the countries take in immigrants and send them without funding to communities that are already under stress from draconian austerity programs. And the same thing happens here. And compounding the whole situation, the austerity policies are eliminating the middle class and with it their purchasing power, which is affecting China.
Jeff Dyer.
I think what you see in Europe, but one of the reasons why so many people want to go to Germany at the moment is because all these other benefits and amount of cash available to refugees is much more generous in Germany than it's going to be in a lot of other European countries, particularly in Eastern Europe. So that's what makes Germany so attractive, but it also was creating some of this pressure as well.
Isn't, as Nancy was saying, you've got an aging population in Germany. You've got new workers that could move in. So therefore, wouldn't it be economically beneficial for Germany to have many, many refugees?
Undoubtedly. The thing is that this is a sudden shock. One thing is to accept immigrants gradually over time and integrate them and absorb them and have just a sudden influx of these desperate people. And as for the money, the leaders, the European leaders that met, they pledged millions for what they call transit countries, for international aid agencies, and up to $1 billion for Turkey. Turkey is home to more than 2 million Syrian refugees, as is the main point of entry to Greece, which is the transit country to Europe. So there is some money available, but as Kathleen said in her call, it's never going to be enough.
Enough. Exactly. Nancy?
I would just add, for all the quotas that are in place, you talk to a lot of these refugees or migrants coming from the region, and they have one country in mind, quotas or not, and that's Germany, because the perception is that is the place that they're going to be welcome. Mm-hmm. And so that may supersede any sort of quotas that we talk about.
Here is an email from Jake, who says, between the Pope's comments and China's recent actions and the upcoming Paris meetings, is there a real sea change on climate change internationally? Could it even start swaying the Republican Party in the U.S., Jeff?
One of the best things that's happened in terms of climate change diplomacy is this greater closeness between the U.S. and China, with the announcements today and then big announcements last year. That is creating a lot of pressure, a lot of momentum behind these big talks that the caller mentioned in Paris later this year, with the hope to create a new global climate change treaty. But there are still lots of problems. I mean, India is another huge emitter, huge economy, very much more more reluctant to get involved in this diplomacy than now China seems to be.
And here's another email from Marcia in Indianapolis. She said, I haven't heard it reported why VW wanted to tamper with emission control. What was their reason? What did they have to gain?
Well, it is to comply with regulatory standards and to
cost more money.
Right. And essentially, there is a trade-off between how fuel efficient you are and how and your emissions. But essentially, there is a regulatory obligation that they were trying to bypass.
But you also sell more cars that way, telling the public that you are emitting fewer.
And that was the central branding
exactly.
message of these cars.
Exactly.
Yes.
All right. And let's go to Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Bill, you're on the air.
Yeah. Hi, Diane. Hi, panel. I was hoping that somebody could give a little feedback on the idea of whether other manufacturers are doing the same thing as Volkswagen. And my thought is a couple of things. It has to do with a very specific pollutant, nitrogen oxide. So, and cars, a lot of diesel cars in the United States, where the EPA has been very focused on this particular pollution. And so my question or suggestion is, wouldn't the best place to look be other manufacturers of similar type vehicles in the U.S. As opposed to just the worldwide diesel industry in general? And do you have any thoughts on that?
Well, Kia and Hyundai have paid $300 million in fines for misrepresenting their emissions. I believe Ford at one point had a similar issue. So we've seen issues of misrepresenting numbers, but not to the scale of creating a system that's put in every car. Now, to your question, are other companies doing it? I have a feeling we're about to find out because of the scandal and the more aggressive inspection, because one of the things that came out of it was a study done by an independent group along with West Virginia University, in which they built a whole system to kind of break the code and figure out why a car would test better in a test setting and not a real world
one. Do you know what the answer is? The answer is that in the testing process, the steering wheel is steady and stable, and therefore no emissions. When you're out on the road, that's when this whole computer system goes off, and then you start emitting.
But it might change testing as well, right? Because of that, the takeaway is perhaps
if
it needs more rigorous
the
testing.
EPA a little more money to test more thoroughly. Yeah. All right, let's go to Linda in Gainesville, Florida. You're on the air.
Good morning. You may have already addressed this issue earlier in the program, but my comment question is, why is there not more world pressure or media exposure of other countries not participating in the immigration crisis and fleeing from war? Russia, Saudi Arabia, Jordan. There are a number of countries who are simply just not taking any refugees, and I'm wondering why that has not gotten more press.
I think that's a fantastic question. I think I would particularly highlight some of the Gulf Arab countries, very, very rich countries. This is their neighborhood. They are participants in the Syrian war in lots of cases.
So what's the answer?
I mean, they simply, I don't want to generalize too much, but they just don't want to be taking in immigrants in that way. I mean, they have very kind of tight control immigration policies. They have all these sort of contract laborers that come in from South Asia. I mean, it'd be politically very hard for them, but this absolutely is the right question to be asking. Why are they not doing more? This should be part of their responsibility.
All right. Let's go to St. Louis, Missouri. You're on the air. David.
Hi. So I'm going back to Volkswagen and why they would bother doing this. And I want to point out that there's just more energy in a gallon of diesel than there is in a gallon of gas. That's where the extra mileage comes from. But what happened was is that Volkswagen is a expert in diesel going back 30 years. And they were using these cars to compete against the Prius and the Honda Insight and the other gas-electric hybrids. And the point is that if you turn all of the emissions on, diesels have a tendency to be slow and sluggish, and they're just not pleasant to drive. And what they were doing is, if you go out on a test drive and you see this car and they say, oh, it's so clean and it drives just like the car you're used to, people will pay extra for the diesel. And if you turn all that stuff back on, then the car will be cleaner, but it will still go back to those old stereotypes of what diesels are, and they just can't compete with somebody like a hybrid.
Yeah.
David raises such a great point, and he explains it so well. So the question becomes, to all those people who thought that they were being environmentally friendly, how do you give them all new cars?
Well,
how do you fix the problem then? But David's summation is beautiful.
And I think that's one of the ones VW is really going to have to deal with. Moises, let's talk about Greece with the leftist leader, Alexis Tsipras, getting back in power.
And surprisingly, he was reelected. He is the leader of the Syriza party.
He knew it was going to happen from the beginning. He sort of planned it that way.
Well, he has proven to be a very adroit, very smart, astute politician. He has gotten away with a lot of contradictions. He has divisive pressures inside his own party, but he has prevailed. And now he has to deliver. And concretely, he has promised that he will renegotiate the deal with the Europeans and try to get some debt relief, and that he was also going to fight the reforms that are required. It is very interesting that the center of the conversation is about austerity, meaning that there's going to be budget cuts of all kinds. But he focuses, rightly so, in structural changes. It turns out that the Greek economy is rife, filled with monopolies and distortions and special interests and all kinds of subsidies that help the rich and some organized interest and hurt the general population. That will not require budget cuts. That just requires the political power to take away some of the privileges that some of these trade groups, business associations, and all kinds.
Do you think he can accomplish that?
Well, he'll have to try. Greece has gone through so much that one expects that at this point the mood is more open, more open to change and tackle these long-standing distortions.
Nancy,
in the Greek
economy.
Nancy, you
look somewhat skeptical.
Well, maybe I'm just too empathetic to the Europeans who've grown impatient with the austerity measures that Greece has taken or not taken. So he'll balance between what the Greeks want him to do and what the European community, the pressure that they're putting on him. And he'll face his first test next month when there's the first review of the economic reforms that are going to be put in place. So that push-pull that he'll find himself in between his population and the European Union, I mean, his charisma has certainly gotten him far. And I have to say that the kind of Greece that he has taken over, not only with the austerity measures, but the migrant issues, it's an extraordinary, complicated time for Greece. And that he was able to win and win so resoundingly certainly speaks to his leadership.
Yeah.
So, I mean, the next big issue is going to be debt relief. And they got this emergency loan a couple of months ago to tide them over. What they now want is to have their overall debt reduced by the creditors, which means another negotiation with the Europeans. This victory gives him a much stronger platform going into that negotiation. And for the other European countries, the key thing that they were watching for was not necessarily whether he would be the next prime minister, but the combination of his government. He did so well that he doesn't need some of the centrist, more pro-European parties that they hoped he would need, but they thought would moderate his demands. He's got a much freer hand politically as he goes into these negotiations with the rest of Europe.
So what about this migrant crisis? To what extent is Greece in a position, considering its fragile economy, to take in more migrants from Syria and elsewhere?
Absolutely no position whatsoever. I mean, you already have sky-high unemployment, austerity, budget cuts, economy in a deep depression. This is the worst possible thing that could happen to Greece in the situation they're in at the moment.
But the migrants don't want to go to Greece. They don't want to stay
there.
They know that Greece is in deep trouble, mm-hmm. that there are no jobs, and the situation is dire. So they are just using Greece as a transit place to reach Germany.
And you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. Let's go now to Billy in St. Petersburg, Florida. You're on the air.
Diane, I'm curious to hear your panel's reaction on how the Volkswagen diesel crisis is going to affect Germany's position going into these negotiations with Greece over austerity, given the fact that, you know, they've sort of shown they're economically cheating somewhat. And then, contrarily, Greece's prime minister being reelected, you know, with such a mandate. And I'll take my answer off the air.
Thanks for calling. Moises.
Well, German public opinion is going to drive much of Germany's position regarding Greece and regarding that negotiations that are inevitable. And yes, they may be a little more shy as a result of the Volkswagen scandal, but it's hard to imagine that we will see a dramatic shift in Germany's posture towards Greece.
Because they hold the ultimate card. There's no other option but them. They are the leader of the European Union. So however more bolstered the incoming prime minister is, It is a European Union being driven by and led by a much more powerful Germany vis-a-vis its other states. And that, to me, will supersede the sort of play, the ability to maneuver the Volkswagen scandal into Greece's benefit.
Jeff.
Yeah, I mean, it's an interesting point, but I don't really see the connection too far. I mean, this is ultimately about corporate Germany and a big company like Volkswagen. And growing up in Europe, as I did, I don't quite know what the reputation of Volkswagen is here, but in Europe, Volkswagen was about reliability, honesty and efficiency. Those are the byword. They're never the flashiest cars on the road, but they were absolutely the solid, most reliable cars you could buy. That's the big issue here for the company and for corporate Germany. That whole image is now in question.
So when you say that whole image is now in question, what does the company have to do in order to regain the trust of people around the world?
I mean, crisis management people would say you have to come completely clean. You have to get all the bad news, all the information out right now from the start. If you can't have any, you can't have a drip feed of further revelations, because if you do that, that's the thing that will really kill you. You can manage this, you can survive this type of crisis if you come clean at the start very quickly. But if there are other things that come out, then that's the real cancer for our company.
I would just add, it seems that they'll have to show fundamental changes in the structure of the company such that people can speak up when they have concerns. There was an accusation that Volkswagen was very central, and people didn't feel that they could come forward with concerns to show that there are structural changes in the organization such that this kind of deception cannot go on this long without being exposed by certainly people below who knew what was happening.
Toyota and the British Petroleum and the Vatican, and there is a long list of organizations and institutions that have brand accidents, you know, catastrophic incidents that hurt their brand. And we have seen how each of them, eventually with time, with firing those that were in charge at the time, recover. So it is a matter of time. But again, the culprits will have to be fired or taken to court. And what is clear is that Volkswagen is a highly centralized company in terms of decision making. So it's very hard to imagine that a lot of people at the top of the organizations were ignorant about this malfeasance.
Moises Naim has the last word. He is with the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. He's a columnist for El País and the author of The End of Power. Nancy Youssef is a senior defense and national security correspondent for the Daily Beast. Jeff Dyer, foreign policy correspondent for the Financial Times, author of The Contest of the Century, The New Era of Competition with China, and How America Can Win. Thank you all for being here.
Thank you.
Thank you, Diane.
Have a great weekend, everybody. Thanks for listening. I'm Diane Rehm.